This is a war between the government and the Tamil people.
I'm not a fucking terrorist. You are the terrorist.
People are crying out for justice in this country.
If you've got to be militant to achieve your aims and your aspirations, so be it.
There's a real hypocrisy from the big corporations.
The people from below will push for real change.
This Australia is going to be shocked, and then the public will say, what the hell's going on?
Welcome to the Indie Media Show on RTR FM 92.1. First up, thanks to Matt for the news there. Also, a huge thank you to Jeff for On The Record. Always such a great addition of On The Record, hearing his dulcet tones on a Monday morning. He'll be back next week, though, and of course you can catch On The Record every weekday here at RTR FM from 9 in the AM. My name is Raymond Grenfell, and I'm joined by Kelly. How's it going, Kelly?
Hello.
And we've also got Brahma in the studio, keeping up the positive vibes. I think he just comes in so he can hear us saying his name on the radio.
He's very happy licking his paws there.
Yep, he loves it. But we're with you until 12 noon today, covering all the news and interviews from the open publishing wires of the interwebs. We're going to be chatting about an issue that we've covered quite extensively on the on the program here, and that is the Scarborough Gas Hub proposal. But we're taking, a different angle this week, as we're speaking to traditional owner Josie Alec, who's from Murujuga, from the Pilbara region, and there's a bunch of folk up there, community members, elders and so forth, that are organising around, trying to stop the Scarborough Gas Hub, and particularly to protect the rock art. And we're talking about some of the most significant and sacred rock art in the world. As we discuss in the interview, there's the first ever depiction of a human circle in the Burrup Peninsula in this rock art up there. And this is all currently under threat as, this Woodside's plan of the Scarborough Gas Hub is, seemingly going ahead. So we're going to be chatting to Josie Alec a bit about that, and also just the lack of consultation that there's been with traditional owners up there. What is really quite shocking. It was quite shocking to hear how little consultation there has been with the TOs up there. So we're speaking to her a little bit later in the show. We're also going to be talking again about the ongoing the invasion of Ukraine and the ongoing conflict there, but looking at a different angle. And that is the sort of the cyber warfare that's been taking place, both in terms of Russia attacking the Ukraine sort of cyber infrastructure at the beginning of the invasion, but also looking at, some other things that have been going on. We've seen groups such as Anonymous hacking Russian cyber infrastructure. But we're going to be chatting about some of the potential implications, even for Australia, in terms of this. When we hear from Paul Haskell Dalland, who is a professor of cybersecurity practice in Edith Cowan University. Indie Media's Alan Boyd spoke to him late last week, so we're going to be hearing all about that on the show as well. Now, we have consistently covered the issue of the proposed Scarborough Gas Hub, the development that will be some 10 times larger in terms of its pollution than the Adani coal mine up in the Murujuga region, or the Pilbara. And it poses a huge threat to, both our climate, but also locally to the sacred rock art that exists in the Murujuga. A group of traditional owners, community members and others had planned to rally up north this weekend, but due to COVID concerns, they've postponed that rally. However, we had the opportunity a little earlier today to speak to Josie Alec. Josie Alec is a traditional owner from the Murujuga region, and I started by asking Josie why the community got together to organise this rally on the weekend.
Firstly, we a lot of our community members around town didn't have any idea that the Scarborough Gas or anything was going to go ahead, or was in existence really. Basically, the it all started at the. Hold on, sorry. So basically, it all started at the end of last year when my niece was actually at a rally down in Perth, and they'd been having rallies down in Perth against Scarborough Gas. And honestly, to tell you the truth, not very many people, like I'd say, not very many traditional owners up here knew about the Scarborough Gas Project and knew that it was being planned to come on Murujuga. Then along with that, we found out that there was Perdaman. You know, they'd made a deal with Perdaman to supply them gas, and Perdaman is another Yarra, which is, you know, another fertiliser project and plant, you know, right next door to Yarra, right on... And we found out they were going to move some significant sacred rock art to put their project there. You know, basically, I think it all sort of just, you know, sort of panned out the way that, you know, we found out about it. And, you know, one of my family is one of the custodial families of that place. You know, hold a lot of connection to there. So we had no, yeah, we just sort of launched into this thing of information that we needed some more information. So some fellows come up, we started talking to them, and they were telling us about it, you know, strangers from Perth, telling us about what's going on in our country, and we had no idea. I tell you, when they told us, I sat there and I basically nearly, you know, cried my eyes out, thinking, what the heck do they think they're doing? Anyway, my niece, Raylene, who was on the board for 10 years of Murujuga Aboriginal Corporation, it was alarming to her as well. She had no idea that this was going on, and she's sitting at the board level there, one of the you know, significant decision makers. So all this underhanded stuff had happened. So we just had to, we've got to do something about it. And basically that's how it came about. So, you know, we're nearly 6 months in or so now, and, you know, we've had one rally in Karratha, and, you know, that was one of the first ones that we held just to raise awareness of this. There was not very many people there, but as we've been going along, you know, a lot of more information have been, a lot more information has been coming up, and we, you know, got to the point where we wrote letters to, you know, we had to write letters to the federal government under, you know, and the acts, the what are those acts called? I've got a brain dead, sorry. So, yeah, we had to, you know, use the Cultural Heritage Acts of Australia, national, to write letters, you know, and get a Section 9 and a Section 10 to see if they would put it in.
Yeah.
Susan Lay came back. We sent that to Susan Lay's office, and we sent it to Ken White's office. Unfortunately, Ken White's office lost it, the letter, which I've sent on email, and it was sent twice. So we had to get reports to follow up on those letters because we had no response. We also, you know, had got some of our other community members around to do, you know, things like, you know, NITV reports and stuff like this as well, just to raise the awareness that we've actually done this, and we want responses from those letters. Thankfully, we did get a response from the letter. Yeah, sorry.
Oh, no, I was just going to say it's sort of beggars belief, though, like what you were saying earlier, the fact that, you know, you've taken this on yourself to find out about what's going on, and, you know, the threat to the, you know, some of the oldest rock art in the world. I mean, we're talking about an area that has the first depiction of a circle in human history. You know, the rock art up there is, you know, incredibly significant, and obviously significant, you know, for all traditional owners. Yet it really sort of demonstrates just a total lack of consultation, and you'd expect, especially in this day and age, and especially with, you know, some of the recent sort of activities of mining companies, that considering a project of this size and this significance, that, you know, Woodside and the companies involved, and of course the state government, would have consulted with traditional owners. But from what you're saying, there just seems to be a total lack of consultation at all.
Definitely. It was a backdoor process. And like I said, my niece sat on the board and didn't know anything about it. So, you know, you've got the top decision makers of that place from five language groups sitting around a table, and they are getting backdoored by these government officials and these big mining companies. And basically they were going around the board and going straight to the elders, who didn't know what they were doing, you know, who didn't know what actually they're talking about. What, you know, and were basically manipulated into saying yes to this project. Now, they came, Perdaman came six times to their circle of elders, and six times they were told no. The seventh time was in front of the board where my niece was sitting that day, and basically two elders made a decision, huge decision, that it was yes, after being, again, manipulated, talked to in language, manipulated by, you know, people who should actually know better. The people that are, you know, should know better about moving that such a culturally significant, you know, the rock art. So it is, I didn't understand it, but that was the process. There was no real due consultation with many of the community members.
You mentioned before that you reached out to the Federal Heritage Minister, Susan Ley, and also Ken Wyatt. I understand, you have received a response from Susan Ley in regard to, holding some of the expansion of the, I believe, at least with Perdaman up there. Well, can you at least sort of speak to what has been sort of promised by the federal government, or what has been committed to in terms of responding to your requests?
Look, they have approved the Section 9 to go ahead, which is they've actually halted work out there. So thankfully, the powers of being have been good to us, and they cannot start to move that rock out or do any works out there. Until the federal minister puts in, from that Section 9, one of their people to come and investigate. So then there's a long process, lengthy process, then that stands after that, which is the consultation of the people, which is under the Section 10. So then they send in their people to come and talk to everybody, basically all the families, everyone, to have their say, which is really good. And a lot of people are coming out now going, well, we didn't have a say. We didn't know our elders are sitting at this meeting, yet again they're so worn down. They don't listen anymore to what's going on in that process of actually them having all the last say. And there are only, there are only a couple of members on the elders board as well. So, and these fellows, you've got to realise, have been doing this for a very long time. So they were also, somewhere in there when it was agreement of the BIMI agreement that they did not understand either 20 years ago, which let Woodside in the first place. There's been a lot of, mishandlings and misconduct on this country. And, we're here to just get the truth. We have, the stories in that rock art are so incredibly amazing, and they belong to the human race. For them to actually come in and just disregard all stories, all knowledge of, that rock art and the energy it holds, the significance of it being attached to Mother Earth and our connection to it. We are the custodians, so we're obligated to look after that place and look after all of our countries. I mean, this, for me, goes all the way down to my country in Panawanika. So this is, and this is my great-grandfather's, great-grandmother's, the Fortescue River. They are all connected. And then going the other way, always this place is connected to this country and to the world.
Yeah, and it's like you say as well, like the art that there is, it's so significant. It's like continuously recording what's been happening in that place for the last 40,000 years. And just looking at the Marajuga Aboriginal Corporation's website, the WA government, the Department of Biodiversity, Conservation and Attractions, as well as Planning, Lands and Heritage, and with Woodside Energy and Rio Tinto, have all been working with Marajuga Aboriginal Corporation to get World Heritage listing. And I guess like what you're saying about them just going through the back door and like on the front talking about wanting to get this World Heritage listing, but then on the back making plans without consultation to go and move the rock art. What do you feel about that? And I guess what do you think that says about the government's priorities?
Oh, look, it's total deception at its best. I can't explain the way I feel about it because it's just a shock. It's how could the people that you put into that we as human beings, as even Ngurrara people of this country, and all the other people, put these people in power to be able to do the right thing for us. And this is not the right thing when you're going handshaking with the likes of, you know, the government and industry. And that's their big thing. Industry can coexist with culture. No, it cannot. When you are blowing up 50,000-year-old rock art or removing it, it's okay, it'll be in a big sheet. No, you don't move it in the first place. I'm very sorry, but how can anybody understand that is the right thing to do? It is not. It is underhanded, and basically, it just everything that they've done is, you know, giving them a green light in their way and their writing and their policies and procedures to do whatever they want on that country while they're getting kickbacks by all of these mining companies. And we all know it. We all know it's true. It's just people need to get out, come out and start waking up and go, this is not right. We need to stand up for this country. We need to, you know, there's climate change, there's floods, there's, you know, we just had a 50-degree day up here. You know, so the emissions coming out of this place right now are absolutely disgusting. Like, we went out yesterday just going out to do a yoga session early in the morning. You know, you're driving back and there's Yarra with its, you know, black smoke pouring out of it. It's compromising our lungs, it's compromising our health, it's compromising our future.
Josie, on that, I mean, as you've so well articulated, the significance of the rock art is under threat up there. But of course, if the Scarborough Gas Hub goes ahead, it will be one of the largest polluters in the Southern Hemisphere. We're looking at something that's, you know, going to be at least 10 times the size of the Adani coal mine in terms of it actually, you know, the emissions it's putting out. And that's going to, you know, be a huge threat on both the local ecosystem, but, you know, the broader global ecosystem. And as you mentioned there, we've got floods and fires already from the climate catastrophe. You know, as a woman who's really charged with protecting country, as you know, as a traditional owner, and you know, and just as a human being, like all of us, you know, how significant is that for you that people will start to wake up and become more aware of this project and start to do what they can to try and stop the Scarborough Gas Hub?
Look, it is you know, it's very vital to the evolution of the world right now. And when we talk about that, we talk about the real evolution of what's going on right now. Now, we all know about ice ages and we all know about, you know, stone ages and the way that the world evolves itself, because we're a part of that evolution. And when we look at these projects, the main thing is, why here? Why there on 40,000-year-old rock art? How can they get away with it when, you know, and put all these emissions in when all the studies have proved the UN have the best scientists in the world saying we need to stop emissions now? And here we are in a country that is full steam ahead and shaking hands with these industries, letting them destruct and destroy the air we breathe, the water we use, you know, and basically a lot of people up here, their livelihoods, because, you know, they build this, people are just going to get sicker and sicker. I mean, for us, I'm a traditional healer, so I also, you know, I work with bush medicine, and the thing that struck me was that their bush medicine out there was way out of whack, so I had to stop using it out there. It's losing its genetic coding to the country. You know, it's losing its genetic connection. So if it's the plants and animals are losing their genetic connection, what the heck is it doing to us? So in a world that, you know, this is, you know, we are all starting to switch on to who we really are and what it is that we're here to do. Well, we come to look after Mother Earth and to live a really sustainable life. That's what Aboriginal people have been doing for all of these years, for, you know, for thousands of years. So if that's not a testimony to how we actually should be going back to live, well, you know, in this this sort of evolution. That's what it's all about. We don't want our kids wiped out. We want a bright future for our children. We want them to know that Mother Earth is here for them, and then they can tap into her and for their own well-being as well. I mean, this is about people's health as much as anything. And I know from up here, because my daughter is an Aboriginal health practitioner, and she has been working with our people and a lot of people through the hospital systems and through healthcare systems. In the short time she's been doing this work, you know, six, 8 years, I think it was, that she's been, she's even can come out and tell you that she has seen the change within the health of people here, and because she's been on the front line. So it's, and that's just here. So just imagine it, you know, everywhere else. And I mean, this, the plant, we can see it from our back door. You can see the flames from your back door. So if we can see it, and the air is, you know, at the right, you know, at the right time, and the wind's blowing, well, we get that emission straight on us, straight in our house. Our animals get it, you know, and not to mention, oh, look, there's so much, but there's also the fact that there are song lines out there that are connected to animals and the plants. And the one biggest song line that we have is the whale. And they're wanting to put this Scarborough gas underwater there, where the whales are coming across, and that's where they migrate. That's their migration area. So that's their song line. So how can they, you know, they're gonna try and, you know, dig up the ground underneath, you know, underneath the seabed, and they think that's okay. It's not going to hurt anything. Well, I'm sorry, but I think it was about a year or so ago, we found artifacts. There was artifacts, and it was a huge thing. There's all these artifacts. There were ships here. It was a big buzz. They found all this water, all this stuff underneath the ocean there, outside, you know, near the islands here, everywhere, in this place. And they want to go and destroy that as well. Like, not only the whales and things, but they're actually going to go through ancient, very old, which is because it's under the sea, obviously. This is, you know, and that there's stories under the water as well, because they have found it. They found sites under the water out there, and it was a big, big find, and they were so proud of it. And all of a sudden, that's backdoor news, and, you know, it's all about, no, we're okay. We're not moving any rock. This is Woodside, mind you. We're not moving any rock. So they're actually telling our mob lies as well, you know, trying to say to them that, you know, they're not moving any rock. They're just expanding on what they have. Well, I'm sorry, that's not good enough. Let's go back to the past. You actually have blown up a whole hill of rock art just to put yourselves there. Mm. So don't act like you're innocent now because you're not moving rock art. You're just expanding what you're doing. But you're still going to be moving rock to expand. You are still going to be desecrating that and destructing all of that stuff, all the earth that's there, to put your lines of your gas pipes through the sea to the land. So, you know, and then having these deals by, you know, what makes it good for them is that they think that they can just, you know, and they've got this deal with Perdaman, that, you know, to make this great big urea plant, and nothing benefits anybody here. So there's no benefit to the world. There's no benefit for the Indigenous people here, none whatsoever, because Murujuga Aboriginal Corporation doesn't have a member service program. They don't have anything for members. They've never have, and they never will. So people think, oh, the Aboriginal people have got all the deals out of this. No, they haven't. They haven't got any deal whatsoever out of this. All that we get is to see our land getting broken and busted up every day by these companies.
Josie Alec, who is a traditional owner of Murujuga on the Burrup Peninsula in Western Australia's Pilbara region, speaking to us a little earlier today. She's also a part of the Save Our Songlines group. As we mentioned, they were intending on having a rally on the weekend, but they couldn't go ahead due to COVID concerns. However, they are having an online rally, and they're going to keep mobilising. And you can find out more information about that group at saveoursonglines.org. You can also find them on the corporate social media as well, and definitely encourage you to support the very good work that they're doing in opposing the Scarborough gas hub.
You're tuned into RTR FM with Kelly, Ray and Brahma, and this is the Indie Media Show. The Australian Cyber Security Centre has urged Australians to be on high alert following the Russian military invasion into Ukraine. As Ukrainian cities came under sustained attack from Russian forces, the country also suffered an ongoing campaign of cyber attacks. Before the conventional land, sea and air strikes, around 70 government websites were temporarily down, the biggest assault on Ukraine in years. The Australian Cyber Security Centre also says there is heightened cyber risk globally and the threat of cyber attacks on Australian networks has increased. While there is no specific intelligence relating to a cyber attack on Australia, this may change quickly. At the same time, a campaign is underway among the hacktivist collective Anonymous, calling on its global army of cyber warriors to target Russia. So, to discuss what a cyber attack is and why we should be concerned, Alan Boyd had a chat with cybersecurity expert Paul Haskell Dowland, who is the Professor of Cybersecurity Practice at Edith Cowan University.
So, who is the Australian Cybersecurity Centre and what do they do? Could you describe what their role is?
They're a government entity that's effectively charged with protecting the cyber interests of Australia. And so their role is to keep an eye on the threats to Australia and particularly to mm-hmm. Australian business, but also to what we often refer to as critical infrastructure. So this is the things that keep us going on a day-to-day basis. And you know, we can think of things like electricity, gas, water, but also our banking sector, transportation, and pretty much everything we interact with on a day-to-day basis. So they're watching out for the threats, they're keeping an eye on the trends, and obviously they give advice and guidance to organisations and individuals to help keep them safe.
Yeah, they also break it down to quite understandable chunks of information for the end user.
They do indeed. It's a big danger in cybersecurity or indeed any tech field to delve into the technology too deeply. Mm. And you know, certainly we could talk ad infinitum about the various threats and their technical components. But for most people, the threats can be boiled down to some very specific risks. And of course, the protective measures that we can use can normally be explained in relatively simple terms. And really focusing on the key things that individuals and organisations can do to keep themselves safe.
Yeah, they seem to do that quite well. And the website, if anyone wants to find out more, is Google the Australian Cybersecurity Centre. And it's a good website, plenty of easy to understand information. So what is a cyber attack? How would you describe that? And especially in terms of cyber warfare, what is a cyber attack, Paul?
So if we put it in terms of what's been happening in Ukraine, you know, a cyber attack would be an individual or an organization who is threatening or performing an attack against some other system or some other organization. So as a very simple example, we have something called a denial of service attack. And again, we could get into the technology side of it, but it's basically making a resource unavailable.
Mm-hmm.
So really simple example would be a website. If I want to take down a website, I have lots of ways of doing it. I can attack the website in various ways, but a very simple technique is to just overload it. And it's no different to a retail store on its opening day, opening its doors and being flooded with hundreds or thousands of people all storming through that one or two doors that have been opened up. You end up with a funnel effect and you just have too much stuff trying to come in.
Like tickets at a grand final, that kind of thing, when it just the system
Absolutely.
Gets overwhelmed. We saw the census website overwhelmed there a couple of years ago, despite so many users all at once. And I suppose that's what a DDoS or distributed denial of service attack, where it basically just shuts the website down because there's too many people trying to get at it. Is that right?
Absolutely. It's a flooding attack. It just basically sends too much traffic or too much requesting connections to that site that it simply can't handle it. And you know, you gave a great example there of the census, that the infrastructure wasn't prepared for the level of demand. It sort of could have been expected, but of course they haven't got the capacity just right. And when it comes to a malicious attack, what we will often see is that the attacks will come from lots of sources. So when you think about a cyber criminal or a criminal gang who is conducting this kind of attack, or, as we're seeing at the moment, the Anonymous Collective, which is targeting websites, it isn't one person or one location that is sending all of that attack traffic. It tends to be hundreds and sometimes even thousands or tens of thousands of individuals acting from around the world, all of whom are concentrating their might on one particular target, or, as we've seen in the recent days, hundreds and even thousands of targets. So the last figure I saw was 1,500 websites in Russia being taken down by the collective known as Anonymous.
Well, on that note, what is Anonymous? So we do hear of them. They're quite a sort of, not necessarily a secret bunch, but what is Anonymous?
Well, they are somewhat secretive, but they also have a very public face. And of course, everyone will recognize the face mask. So we've seen it at various protest marches.
Yep.
But it tends to be the iconographic image that they hide behind, because fundamentally, Anonymous is anonymous. And so the people who align themselves with Anonymous will use the mask to hide identity, primarily because what they're doing is illegal. And in most cases, it would be a criminal act to engage in the kind of activities that the Anonymous, and I want to say members, but they're not an organization. So those who are affiliated to Anonymous will usually use the face mask and hide behind anonymity to be able to engage in their criminal acts in most cases. But they are what we would refer to as a hacktivist entity. So they are an activist organization in everything other than being an organization, but they use the sort of cyber techniques, often referred to as hacking techniques, to enact their objectives. So whether that's taking down websites, or whether it's compromising systems or stealing information that can then be utilized by the people that they claim to represent or support in whatever battle or warfare they're currently engaged in.
Yes, they're quite prolific in what they do. You can follow them on Twitter. There's lots of they're very public. You're right. They're out there, and they like to tell the world about the things that their group does, and they're quite effective. Do you think that the effect of Anonymous is useful in terms of attacking the Russian government in this particular instance?
It's actually quite an interesting topic to discuss, because Anonymous as an entity is primarily representing the downtrodden, or the targets of oppression around the world, and they've taken up many very worthy causes, but the mechanisms by which they do so are largely illegal and certainly are contravening various laws in various countries. But of course, they are tending to engage in scenarios that are not being supported by the law enforcement agencies, or in this case, by the relevant governments around the world. And they're sort of the voice of the people. So they hold the popular view that everyone feels that Ukraine is subject to a foreign invasion and that it is unfair and unjust. And the global governments collectively are really not doing very much other than imposing sanctions. So it's quite understandable that the public look at this and think actually they're doing a good job and they're supporting the Ukraine.
Taking direct action, as you would say, in a protest.
They are, but there is a real danger with this approach, because we've seen before that cyber attacks, even when apparently targeted at a location, have a tendency to spread. Now, we've not seen any significant problems out of the current engagement, because they primarily targeted very specific organizations. So, for example, Russian banks and Russian state media. And so the kinds of attacks they're doing are very targeted, and they don't tend to spill over. But unfortunately, as the inevitable happens and this situation escalates, we're likely to see more aggressive forms of cyber warfare. And they do tend to have collateral damage. And we saw that very effectively a few years back when a Russian aggression against the Ukraine in the form of the NotPetya ransomware spread across the globe in a matter of days and became a multi-billion-dollar impact around the world. So not all cybercrime or all cyber attacks end up targeting the original intended victims. They can spread, unfortunately.
Okay, so back to the Australian Cybersecurity Centre's warning to be on high alert, Australians to be on high alert following the Russian military invasion. What sort of attacks are the Russian government capable of, firstly, and then, but how would this affect Australians?
So I think just as with Anonymous, we shouldn't underestimate either the capability or the willingness to use cyber attacks against other countries. And you know, Russia has got form in this space. And again, the example I gave of the ransomware attack against the Ukrainian nation actually spread globally and had massive impacts.
Yep.
There is significant capability within Russia. Now, Russia's not alone in this. Most global states will have some kind of offensive cyber capability. And indeed, Australia does. It's not something that we hide, but obviously we do have very strict rules of engagement within Australia, as do many of the Five Eyes partners in terms of their cyber capabilities. Russia, however, has had a few questionable engagements in the past, and of course does play by very different rules. And as we've seen in this particular case, the willingness to use you know, very high impact engagement strategies within the Ukraine and the impacts on civilians is something clearly that Putin is quite prepared to utilize. So Russia definitely has the capability, has invested significantly in its cyber capability. And another factor which is often overlooked is that for many years now, Russia has been almost the base of operations for many criminal gangs. Mm. And you can guarantee that the Russian government and the intelligence agencies there have been well aware of the activities and the individuals engaged in criminal activities. And they've sort of given a blind eye to them, really on the understanding that they don't target domestic individuals or organizations. In other words, it's okay to attack others, just don't attack us. Now, in a time when you're wanting to engage in cyber warfare, it is quite possible that the Russian intelligence agencies and the military agencies will be reaching out to some of those groups and perhaps bringing them in-house, bringing them on board to support the Russian state and its engagements in these attacks. So I think there's some really significant concerns in the future, both in Russia and obviously, you know, globally in terms of cyber engagements.
So what sort of, just briefly, what sort of things can they do? How do they do it in terms of the attack surfaces, that kind of thing?
The obvious things that could be done are the very things that we're seeing at the moment coming from the Anonymous attacks, and that would be things like denial of service. So they are very effective attacks that Russia and many other states are perfectly capable of deploying really against any target. So that would be using a range of systems and not necessarily systems based in Russia. They could be located globally and using them to attack various probably websites. So targeting significant organizations like the Australian Cybersecurity Center, that would be a really good target as a high profile impact that the Russian government could claim if they wanted to. And then we look at the more traditional, what we would refer to as hacking activities that we would typically see from the cyber criminals in terms of targeting individuals, their accounts, targeting banking, and looking to steal information, so intelligence operations, targeting you know, financial organizations, targeting lawyers. That would be a really good target if you're looking to get intelligence on cases and individuals. And of course, the intelligence agencies and the military themselves would be really useful organizations to extract intelligence from. So there's a whole range of ways in which these cyber attacks could be utilized. And of course, at the same time that all this is happening, we're going to see a rise in the traditional cybercrime coming out of cyber criminal gangs, because they will sort of hide behind the noise of these attacks and, you know, will have almost plausible deniability that it's just another attack linked to the current situation. So we're likely to see a whole range of different kinds of attacks hitting Australia.
So such as what? And how would we protect ourselves from such attacks?
So, I mean, things like denial of service attacks are really targeting infrastructure. Sorry, you were going to say?
No. I'm just please keep going.
So things like denial of service attacks are an obvious example because they target infrastructure. So again, as a very simple example, targeting websites. So if you can target the website of a major news organization, it has a significant disruptive effect within a country. Now, you could argue that taking down the ABC News website doesn't actually have any major implications. No one really loses any money, probably not going to lose a lot of sleep over it. But it does have an impact on a country. People will see that they are vulnerable. It will start to raise concerns and maybe even questions about the relevant engagements. And you know, that's being used to great effect at the moment in Russia with the Russian media being targeted and websites being taken down. If you also look at you know, other targets within Australia, obviously banking would have a major impact. So if you could hit the banking websites, the online banking that we use, and effectively deny access to those, that has a very real impact on citizens, and that obviously can change mindsets and change viewpoints within a country. And if you take that further, you know, the infrastructure that handles our banking transactions, so the mechanisms by which financial transactions move around the country, our systems for controlling ATM machines, and our ability to withdraw cash, all of these systems are critical to our day-to-day lives. And so you can guarantee that the banking sector, the whole of the financial industry, will be keeping a very close eye on the systems and the traffic coming into them and examining their vulnerabilities. And of course, their exposure in the global marketplace. And we've already seen the banking systems impacted in Russia as a consequence both of internal attack, but also with external sanctions. But they do have a ripple effect. And so organizations that trade with Russia, or indeed who have supply chains through Russia or Belarus, who is also affected at the moment, will see impacts on business. And that can have very real impacts on financial viability for organizations.
That was Paul Haskell Doland, the professor of cybersecurity practice at Edith Cowan University. He was speaking to Indie Media's Alan Boyd about the increasing risk of cyber attacks following Russia's invasion on the Ukraine.
And this is the Indie Media Show on RTR FM 92.1 with Ray, Kelly, and Brahma.